Well, my name's Steve Baker. I'm a self-employed developer based in Wellington, New Zealand, and I'm a developer on the GStreamer multimedia project. I've been involved for about 2.5 years. So I'm here to give you an overview of the architecture and where it's going, and hopefully at the end we'll have some time for some demos. So what is GStreamer? It's a library for building multimedia applications. So when you get GStreamer as a user, you know, you don't even know you've got it, because you know, it's the apps that use it. But what it does is it allows apps to be built out of graphs. You can build complex graphs from simple small elements. And you can support any data type for which you can write an element for. And one important thing is that GStreamer, the core GStreamer library, doesn't know anything about multimedia at all. It doesn't know about video, and it doesn't know about audio. It's all in the elements. And elements generally live in plugins. And plugins allow support for specific media-specific extensions. And plugins can contain things other than elements. Can contain typefind functions or schedulers. So you can extend GStreamer and multiple ways just through the plugin architecture. The main core dependency is glib. We extensively use the G object typing system, which makes it easy to have nice clean designs in C, with the slight disadvantage that there's quite a lot of code you have to write just to get the basic framework in place. It runs on Linux, Solaris, FreeBSD. Maybe one day it'll run on Windows, but someone has to do the work. Maybe the Mac as well. The Mac support might be getting a bit closer. But yeah, someone's got to do the work. We use third-party libraries where possible. We've got no interest in rewriting everything from scratch. This means that we link to a hell of a lot of libraries. Which makes it a bit of a packaging nightmare and can be a challenge to build sometime. But it's a lot better than it used to be. A lot of the libraries we depend on are more and more in the distribution, so it's a lot easier to do it than it used to be. Now, one common misconception, which is probably going away, is that GStreamer is not a sound server. It's just a library. In the same way that GTK is a toolkit library to build user interface applications, GStreamer is a library to build multimedia applications. However, you could build a sound server with GStreamer. GStreamer also is not a player. It's not a player library, but you could use it to build a player. And that's the thing we're focusing on for the moment to be really good at. Be good for players, but in the future, it's going to be a lot more complex applications like non-linear editors and whatnot. We're associated with the GNOME project. We're going to hopefully be in the 2.6 release of GNOME with our latest version. We'll have a lot of new features, but we're not GNOME specific. There's various KDE projects that are using GStreamer, and it may get more and more blessed by the KDE people as time goes on. A while ago, Linux had really crappy media handling. It's a little bit better now, but at the time there was many hacked single-purpose apps and libs. So GStreamer was, a way to address that situation. And one of the main reasons that it was started as well is because everyone else was doing it. Microsoft's got DirectShow, Apple's got QuickTime, so why not? Currently, there's a few applications that are using GStreamer. Rhythmbox and Totem are probably the two that are most common. They both also have Xine backends. But I think after the next release of GStreamer, which is due in March, the GStreamer backend will be a lot more used. GSD Player is our experimental media player like Totem, but it's not really in competition with it, because Maintainer also works on Totem, so. There's proof for you. The GNOME Media package has GNOME Sound Recorder, and GST Mixer is a hardware audio mixer, which is good for the GNOME project because they no longer have to link directly to OSS or Elsa Lib. all I just have to do is link to GStreamer, and GStreamer does the job of detecting what audio architecture they're using. And that means that we can add new architectures for new platforms in the future, and it'll just work for GNOME, which is good for them. SoundJuicer is an application which turns your audio CDs into nice OGG files, and Marlin is a audio editor. It's relatively early stages. Video Whale is a very interesting project. It was written by a guy in Pakistan who needed a video wall. So he got 16 computer monitors, plugged in 4 computers, and one server. He wrote a GStreamer server which split up the video into 4, and then GStreamer client application which projected its little bit onto 4 monitors. So you get a grid of 16. And it was done because there's not a lot of money floating around in Pakistan. So if they want a video wall, they have to repurpose some PCs, build it up. They can have it going, and once their event is over, they can put them back again and use those PCs for normal things. Then the two at the bottom there, Nonlin is a non-linear editing library, which is still in the early stages of development, but it'll come to something at some time. And VDV is a DVD player, an experimental one based on the Python bindings. You're up here. Yes, please write your instrument applications. The core library is licensed as LGPL. Apps used to be GPL, but now they're LGPL just because we wanted to get around patent GPL violation issues. Doesn't mean that you can't write a GPL application, but it would be up to you to not run patented plugins. Because it's plugin-based, it allows distributions to ship the core GStreamer and friendly plugins and leave out the patent-encumbered ones, which is exactly what Red Hat's done. So it means GStreamer can still be there, and if the user wants to extend it themselves, then they can find the libraries themselves and whatnot. In theory, we support third-party binary plugins, but it hasn't happened yet. We haven't had a lot of success in convincing Apple and Real to put their codecs to our library. I don't think it'll happen personally, but someone else might have their own proprietary stuff that they want to distribute. It might become more common when the API stabilizes a little bit more. Language bindings. There's a whole bunch. Some of them are more stable than others. A lot of them have their own applications that the plugin developers are using to develop with. There's some good Qt ones. My personal favorite is the Python ones. Some are better than others. Now, if you're a GStreamer developer, there's some command line tools that you'll probably use quite often. And GST Editor is the tool which created this image. It lets you graphically build pipelines. And what we see here is a very simple MP3 player. You've got a file source, MP3 decoder, and a sound card. GST Launch is a command line version of GST Editor, which lets you quickly put together pipelines and see what they do. And here is the same pipeline with a file source loading a suspicious looking song. Pipe to MP3 decoder and the sound card. We use a bang symbol for a pipe, which has been kind of handy, because you don't have to rejig your brain from shell scripting. GST Register builds an XML registry of all the plugins and all the features that those plugins have. This makes loading GST applications faster, because it wouldn't have to load all those libraries on startup. And GST Inspect just gives you some information about particular installed plugins, so you can query what you've got and what it does. Yes, it's unfortunate that GST has some tax implications in this country, but not a lot we can do about that. Pipelines and elements. So these are individual elements, and you can join them together to form complete pipelines. Each element does one thing and theoretically does it well, in the Unix way. In the way we've shown it, data and events flow from left to right, and sometimes events flow from right to left. an example of an event would be, say, a seek event. If you wanted to seek to a certain position in the file, you could do a seek event. Say, I want to go back 30 seconds. Say that to the sound card, I want to go back 30 seconds. And the MAD decoder converts that into bytes and does a seek for bytes, and the file source seeks to that and then sends the data on downstream. Now, if it was a variable bit rate, that wouldn't be very accurate, but if you wanted more accuracy, we could put in an index element in here, and that could build up a mapping between, you know, timestamps and exact byte offsets. That would let you have, you know, sample accuracy for seeking. Now, elements have pads, which are these pink things. They're called pads, you know, because it comes from the electronics, you know, when you're soldering pads together with two wires. So here we've got pads that are connected together. And data and events flow through the pads. But before the pads can be, before data can flow through the pads, then the pads have to negotiate what mutual capabilities that they support. And this can get very complicated, because you've got one plugin that has one set of capabilities and another plugin which has another whole set of capabilities, and you want to find a union of those capabilities and then find one particular, you know, settings of capabilities that you want to use. But it even gets worse than that, because some plugins, you know, they don't care, you know, so let's take a resample plugin. All it does is change the sample rate. So you know, the sound card wants to, you know, it wants to know how many channels it's going to come through. And the resample plugin goes, well, I don't know, it's the same amount of channels that I get given at the other end. And, you know, so it has to delay the capability checking until some actual data flows down it. And it goes, oh, okay, two channels. Okay, now we can negotiate caps with the sound card. Okay, now we can play some sound. Some pads only appear on demand. A typical example would be a video demultiplexer. You know, it doesn't know what's in the stream until it actually starts decoding the stream. So say MPEG, you know, it'll decode some and say, oh, there's a video stream here. I'll create a video pad. And then, you know, it'll tell the application, and the application goes, oh, I want a video pad, I'll connect to that, and we can play some video. The data flows through the pipeline in buffers. Those buffers may not always be writable too, so you always have to check. If you really want to write to it, then you should do a check. Well, you actually call a function and you may get back the same buffer to write to, or you may not. Done for optimization reasons. Allocating and copying memory is avoided where possible. We've done a lot of work on optimization. And the good thing about what we've ended up with is that optimizations can often be done without without other elements being aware that they're happening. For example, for file input, we're memory mapping the file into, you know, 4 meg chunks and then chopping those up into little buffers. And those buffers are just sent downstream, so, you know, there's no copy operations there. There's a chance that a downstream buffer might want to, you know, that they're getting a buffer, but maybe they want their data on different buffer boundaries. Now, normally they'd have to, you know, read two buffers and join them together, and it would all be very horrible. But we've got what's called a byte stream library, which lets you change the buffer boundaries. And if it's, you know, a continuous chunk of memory, then it just moves the boundaries. It doesn't actually do any copying. So that's a huge win for more complex elements. There's basically three different kinds of elements that you can write. When people ask, is it a push-based graph network or a pull-based graph network, it's kind of both. The most simple elements are chain elements. You know, you're given a buffer and you give another buffer out. There's always a one-to-one relationship. So if you can write it as a chain element, you know, that's the best way to go. But not all elements can be written that way. Loop elements are a bit more complex, but they can pull as many buffers as they like, and they can give out buffers as often as they like. So it gives a lot more flexibility, but at the cost of slightly more complexity in programming. And finally, we have get elements, which all they do is provide buffers. So that would be file sources or network sources or whatever. So here, this example, this would be a get element. This is probably a loop element because it's, there's not necessarily one-to-one correlation between the data coming in and audio going out. And this would be a chain element, even though there's nothing coming off the other end. Core elements that are built into GStreamer. This is a pipeline that does nothing. Creates some fake data, sends it off to two fake syncs, one's in a thread. But it shows what some of the core elements are. There's a subclass of an element called a bin, which can contain other elements. And one of those bins is a thread, which will run your elements in a separate thread, which comes in very handy. And all you have to do to use threads is to put a queue between each one to decouple the buffers. That queue will just accumulate buffers, and when the thread's ready to take them, it'll just take them as fast as it can. And then a T just splits the flow into two paths, so the buffer will go into two directions. It doesn't necessarily duplicate those buffers because maybe no one's writing to them, so there's no danger in just sending the same one out. Okay, there's a whole bunch of input elements. Now that this isn't even close to listing all of them, but it gives you an overview. There's inputs, file, name, DFS, UDP, DVD, outputs to file, sound card, the screen, a network, and a codex. The FFmpeg project has encoders and decoders for all the evil proprietary video formats and audio formats. And so whatever ends up in Zine or in Player ends up in GStreamer because it's the FFmpeg code base. It's all the same thing. Filters, there's audio effects like LADSPR and video effects like the Effect TV project, which I'll show you later. There's multiplexers and demultiplexers for container formats like QuickTime, Etrosco, and AVI, and lots of other stuff. For audio-video playback, here's a example of a hard-coded MPEG player. We've got an MPEG demultiplexer, and then it's being sent off to two queues. There's an MP3 decoding, and then the MPEG video decoding going to a display. You'll see these two threads. You would think that they would just go as fast as they can, and audio and video would be completely out of sync, and it would just be a disaster. But it doesn't, because we have clocking. And clocks work by the sound card is used as the clock base because it's precise, but it's not necessarily accurate. So it's a perfect contender. It may be wrong time, but it's exact wrong time. Any real-time elements will synchronize to whatever default clock it can find. So the sound card will publish itself as a clock, and the video elements will sync to that. Now, if this thread wasn't there, and let's say this was a file sync or something, then this pipeline will just go as fast as it can because there's no clock. So that's very important for other classes of application that just do batch processing or whatever. Schedulers is where the real magic happens. They're what decide when each element is asked for data. There's a lot of foo that goes on in there. The co-threads are interesting things. They're also called co-routines or user space threads. And in many ways, they're simpler and faster than real threads to use. It's a shame people don't use them more often. They work because the application explicitly controls when each co-thread is running. So instantly, you don't have to worry about locking or race conditions or anything like that because it's all under the app's control. It also means context switching is extremely fast because all it has to do is run a tiny bit of assembler which saves and loads the stack for each co-thread. Now the original scheduler created a co-thread for each element, but the current default scheduler doesn't do that, at the cost of being a slightly higher latency, which generally doesn't matter for, say, player type applications. So if latency matters to you, then you can switch back to the co-thread based one. Auto plugging is also a very handy feature. We have a special element called spider, and each media type has its own type finding function. So the job of spider is to take some raw data, and all it knows is that someone's trying to connect to it for video and someone's trying to connect to it for audio, and then it tries elements until it can deliver those required streams. And the structure that it ends up with could be quite complex. You could have a demultiplexer, followed by a decoder, and then maybe another decoder, and a video decoder, followed by a color space plugin, until it finally gets to delivering the data types that the syncs are wanting. Probably the most problems that we've had with GStreamer are probably related to Spider. It needs a rewrite. A lot of the API changes that we've been doing in core have been making this rewrite easier. So sooner or later, someone's going to tackle this project. Hopefully it'll happen before the March release. So new features currently in development. There's a lot of subsystems are being rewritten in the development version at the moment. But new systems for content negotiation, metadata, and capabilities. The most recent one is capabilities, which broke every single plugin in the tree, but we've recovered quite well from that. Initially when GStreamer was being developed, a lot of effort was put into the API for one element to talk to another element. That's where the bulk of the development effort went. A little bit less went to applications dealing with the GStreamer library generically. But one thing that's been missing until recently is applications dealing with specific elements. In the olden days, the only way you could really interact with a specific element was through GObject properties, which was pretty primitive and painful. You can only set key-value pairs on fundamental types, and it was quite frustrating. But now we can write interfaces for specific purposes. A good example would be the audio mixer interface. It's used by a GST mixer, and it extracts a sound architecture, so you can find out how to change the volume on the sound card, and how to switch on channels and how to record and all that. So now we can build richer applications because we can deal directly with the plugins. And multiple plugins can implement the interfaces. It's just like Java interfaces. You can have different implementations for different purposes or different plugins. Other ones include video overlay, which basically just shows the video on the screen. Property probing to find kernel devices, and interactivity for DVD menus and Flash, which is one feature that really been missing until now. I've actually got a demo of DVD working DVD with interaction, which is good. Okay, here's some actual code. This is using the Python Python bindings. It has the error checking taken out so it can fit on the screen, not because there was no error checking. So it's just like the MP3 pipeline we were looking at before. At the top level, we've always got to have a pipeline, which is the bin that contains everything. And then we have a file source, and setting the location to the file path that's been passed in. Then we're creating a Vorbis element, and then another OSS sync element. Once we've created them, then we just add each one to the bin in turn. And once they're added to the bin, then they can be connected one at a time to each other. Once they're connected, then you set the state to plain and iterate ad infinitum. If I just go back, see there's four little symbols here. These represent the state of the pipeline. The first state is the null state, which only happens at when the pipeline's first created and just before it's destroyed. Then we've got the ready state, which is, you know, when the pipeline's ready to go, it's all set up and it's about to do something. Then we've got paused and playing. And that can all be changed, and individual elements can be in different states, you know, if you want to do clever stuff. But if you want to just make it play, then just set the top pipeline state to playing, and everything else will just cascade and it'll all happen. Right, demos. How am I doing? Okay. Now I decided to be a little bit postmodern and turn my presentation into a video and then play the video with GStreamer and be really clever and stuff. So what I did was I exported it as JPEGs and then used the MJPEG tools utilities to turn that into a non-system stream MPEG file. And that can be decoded with this pipeline. I've got a file source, MPEG decoder, and XP image sync. See what it does. Okay, that's kind of fast. That's because it's just going as fast as it can, because there's no frame rate on it. So to make that a little bit more reasonable, let's insert a video drop element. Okay, that's a little bit better. So this video drop element just adds and removes frames to change, you know, the frame rate. It doesn't use fancy interpolation. It just chops frames out or adds them. But it you know, does the job. So now we can, you know, start to do stuff with it, like add effects. This reminds me of when I was trying to finish my presentation after the speaker's dinner. And then we can, you know, maybe add some more effects. I think someone spiked my drink. So you know, you can just keep on building onto the pipeline like that. If we have a look at this pipeline, I've inserted a couple of color space plugins. That's because the MPEG to decoding produces some kind of YUV color, probably I420 or something output, and these Effect TV plugins don't understand YUV; they only do RGB. So stick in a color space plugin, and you know, color space figures out the necessary conversion, does all the complicated caps negotiation, and it all just works. And then at the end, I have to put in another color space plugin because my XP image sync doesn't do the particular kind of RGB that that the Effect TV plugins use. So, just to prove that it's not just for playing, I've got my really crappy webcam, which if we're lucky we'll get some kind of smudged. Yep, wave to yourself. That's about all that does at the moment, because it's a little bit touchy. Okay, I was going to do a DVD demo, but I've got to change some code first. There's a fix that broke my demo, so I've got to put it back. Okay, because I'm rebuilding a plugin, then I have to re-register the plugins, because otherwise it'll get upset, because it'll see that a plugin has changed and it doesn't know. It might have some new features, and those features aren't in the registry, so we need to rebuild the registry. So now I should be able to play the DVD. The only DVD I own is the South Park movie. But the only reason I own it is to do GStreamer development, so you know, I think that's okay. So here we have a menu, and if I click that, then it works. Hurrah! So that's about, you know, that's pretty exciting for us. Now there's some novelty elements. Before I even show this, I'll tell you now, the best way to see this is to squint your eyes, like, so you can barely see. It'll work a lot better then. Working? Hey! what have we got here? Now, if I run the GST player application, actually, I'll play the DVD again. So there's DVD, you know. Looks pretty good. Now we have a bunch of gconf parameters which lets you actually change the change your output syncs. You might want to do that because you know your sound card is particularly useless and it only does 48 kilohertz or something. So we've got these, you know, video syncs and audio syncs. But the cool thing is, this also uses the same launch syntax that that I was using in GST launch. So I could do something like, that. Now rerun the player. Wait. Some more. Yeah. Right, if it comes to this, not gonna work. Oh, duh. Now we have classic Warner Brothers. You can see the speckle. And so, soon these gconf keys, they're not going to be used much because we're going to have auto detection in place. So, you know, it's going to detect if you have XV enabled X, and if it doesn't, then it'll, you know, just, there's an alternative, you know, plugin which doesn't require XV. Also, it'll detect whether you've got OSS or ELSA. But if you want to override those automatic settings, then this will be the place to do it. Okay. Well, I'll just quickly show you. I can show you auto plugging. Okay. Here we've got a video file, and I'm feeding it through Spider and connecting it to an image sync. So. Spider will do all the hard stuff about figuring out what elements have to go there, and it'll just build a pipeline and away we go. I could build a more complicated pipeline which has audio and video, but I just can't be bothered. But I can now show you the video and the sound. So, you know, that's Spider in action. You know, just. The whole point about it is that it just works, usually. And finally, I guess I've got a couple of minutes to show you the editing application. Let's just build a really simple pipeline, just really quickly. So here, by default, we've got a pipeline that we can put stuff into. First, mute a source, make an audio source. Let's have a sine wave, they're exciting. Now we want to send that to SoundCard, but first, I've actually got to. Converter, audio convert, because my sound card's doing something funny at the moment, which I don't understand. And then sync, audio, OSS. So now I've got my elements, and I connect them together. If I click on one, then I can see the properties that this element supports. And I've got a frequency, buffer size, volume. Now if I just click this off, sine waves! Or square waves, by the sound of it. So that's the editor. And that's pretty much it. I think we've got some time for some questions. Yep. Yeah. That's not actually event. That actually happens during the CAPS negotiation. And what happens in that situation is, the sound card wants to negotiate CAPS, and you know the resample one just says I can't do it now, so it sends a delayed CAPS message back. So the sound card goes, okay, I'll ask again later, and then once it gets some data through, then it negotiates CAPS. Yeah, the event goes upstream automatically until some element wants to deal with it. And then I might send another event on, depending on what happens. Yeah. Another question? Yep. Pretty good. The overhead of the core architecture is really low. So the performance you'll see would be pretty much the same as the performance of the underlying libraries that are decoding your media. Of course, I've showed you pipelines with three threads in them, which is required at the moment. So there's an overhead there. In the future, it would be possible to build player-like pipelines without any threads, but it's going to need a change of API and someone to figure out the right way to do it. But threads are still as good as they can be. How does it choose the what? Say you are building an application. You will know what is the last element in the pipeline. So you always just send your seek events to the last element, and it'll just go upstream and it'll work itself out. You can choose which one, and it'll still flow upstream. Yeah. As a player, you could send the seek event to the sound card or the video display element or both, and it would still probably work. Yep. Yep. You saw the video drop element in action. That would do exactly that. It would just drop frames to show you what you want. All the elements are there. There's the resample element, the only thing we have to be careful of is that the timestamps are correct for the new speed. So if it doesn't work now, it's a bug. Yep. Yep. Yep, it's possible. Not in a completely transparent way. For example, you could use the UDP source and sync to Yeah, not in the way that you're suggesting, but yeah. No one's shown interest in doing it. You know, there's nothing stopping it from doing it. The only tricky thing is, you know, writing the software that does all the caps negotiation over the wire. But you know, it's certainly possible. Just got to design a protocol. Yep. Oh, it depends on the plugin. I mean, basically for consumer type applications, it's, you know, generally going to be 16-bit short, you know, interleaved stereo. But for professional, you know, Paul Davis compliant audio, it's going to be float, mono, going through multiple pads if you want multiple channels. Yep. What's the what? Hasn't been measured recently, but it should be pretty good, unless you use threads. And when I talk about the latency of the scheduler, the latency will grow with the length of the pipeline. So, you know, if you want less latency, use shorter pipelines or use the different scheduler. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but the current default scheduler is working pretty well. You know, we don't use as many co-threads. So when the original problem was that co-threads were running out of stack space because the stack space is split up into a stack space for every single co-thread. So, you know, there's a trade-off between the number of co-threads and the size of your stack. If the stack gets too small, then, you know, badly designed plugins are going to freak out. So, you know, we don't have that trade-off anymore because the new scheduler uses, you know, very few or no co-threads. Yep. Yes, you can. Mileage may vary, but if it doesn't work, it's a bug. So yeah, speaking of bugs, you know, if you want to get into this, then, you know, join the chat room, report bugs if you find any, please. We need people to write more plugins. We need people to write applications. And once you've done that, you know, you might be inspired to work on the core. Is there any other questions? Yeah. Question was how does it work with, you know, sources that are unreliable, might be lossy. Again, it depends on the downstream elements. Like, you know, MP3, because there's so many crappy MP3s out there, the MP3 decoder is pretty solid. So if you're streaming MP3 over the network and there was dropouts, then, you know, it would cope pretty well. Yeah. So yeah, it depends on that element. Yes, there's a mixer element for pro audio, for float audio, and for integer audio, and I think there's video mixers as well. But you know, there's going to be a lot more video work coming up because it's just, you know, stabilized. Shortcuts, yes. I can't remember, it may even use GNOME VFS with a few hacks to get the shortcut stuff, or it might be its own plugin, I can't remember. But it does work, and I haven't seen that yet, but yeah, not yet. I mean, but Rhythmbox has had pretty good you know, streaming audio support for quite a while, for radio stations and stuff. Yeah? Oh, Well, I know Source definitely works, but there are syncs for streaming audio as well. And I think someone wrote some Java bindings and was serving a radio station using GStreamer for quite a while, a few months ago. So yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks so much.